Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It takes nearly a year of training to become a licensed barber in Ohio, but one can become an emergency medical technician in fewer than 6 weeks. That's 250 hours for cosmetics versus 150 hours for saving lives. We're talking about efforts in the Ohio General Assembly to scale back state licensing requirements and how they may disproportionately limit women, minorities, and former felons. Joining us by phone is the CEO of Gender Equity Analytics. That's a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity, Julie Graber. Welcome back, Julie.
Hey, Ann. Thanks for having me.
What is known about the relevance of licensing and certification requirements and the upward mobility of women in the workforce?
Well, there are a couple of challenges that the licensing creates, especially given that it's done state by state and the requirements may be very different from state to state. It impacts women's geographic mobility. It can be a limit to entrepreneurship, so owning their own businesses and expanding them. Without the license, it can limit their employment or and wages. So the difference is state by state, as well as whether the requirements are actually related to the public health and safety are the questions that are being raised about occupational licensing.
So proponents of easing the licensing requirements in Ohio say that they take women and minorities out of the workforce and burden them with too much debt for jobs. Is that what you're talking about when it limits entrepreneurship? They're too burdened with other costs of entry?
Yeah, it may be that it also can limit their business growth or even, there was a case in Missouri, for example, where hair braiders had to have cosmetology licenses, even though there's nothing about hair braiding covered in the education related to getting a cosmetology license. And the Women's Foundation in Missouri was actually successful in getting hair braiding exempted from the cosmetology license requirement, which opened up an opportunity for women to work in that area without having to go through school and all the licensing requirements.
Is there anything in the research that shows that these kinds of licensing requirements were, you know, started or the trend toward them started in any effort to limit access into these fields?
Well, that is certainly one of the things that causes people concern about it, that the very folks generally who are making the recommendations about the licensing requirements at the are typically like boards and commissions at the state level. And the question is always, is the requirement really related to the public's safety and health, or is it about limiting the number of people who can be in a particular field and reducing competition?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about licensing and certification requirements in Ohio. They differ from state to state. Ohio, in some cases, is one of the most onerous. They license and certify people who work in everything from auctioneering to upholstery to cosmetology to EMTs. If you are one of those people that had to pay to be certified and also had to be schooled for certification and feel strongly about this one way or the other, we'd like to hear from you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest right now is Julie Graber. She's the CEO of Gender Equity Analytics. That's a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity. You know, the jury on this, so to speak, in the Ohio General Assembly is pretty much split along political lines. And I'm just wondering, as far as when it comes to the relationship between certification and licensing and organized labor and that kind of a thing, if that plays any role in this that you know of, Julie?
Actually, even though our legislature may be split at this point, this is actually, and some of your other guests may be able to speak to this more specifically, this is somewhere where the parties sometimes cross over and work together. I mean, the Obama administration did a study of occupational licensing in terms of questioning both the need for it to vary so much state by state, as well as, you know, whether the requirements are really need to be as strict as they are. But how it plays with organized, with labor unions, mm-hmm. I mean, that there lobbying can certainly play into what is passed as requirement. And again, the question is it a legitimate need based on public safety and health, or is it about limiting or at least controlling both entry into the marketplace or the need to have to go through one of these a trade association or a union in order to be able to work in the field.
Let's see. Andrew in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a sister who's actually a cosmetologist. She works in Detroit, Michigan right now, but she got her license here in Columbus. And I myself have been working in the food industry for the past 12 years, and I was just wondering why it was such a big requirement for her to get a license to do her job and me not really having the requirement to get a job in the industry like food. I mean, we have high school students working in the food service industry, you know, to prepare themselves for the working life. And I was just wondering why it's so important that something is cutting hair is required for a license, but serving people food that could be significantly more dangerous is not as important to get a license. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Andrew. Thanks a lot. Now, Julie, I know you're not necessarily an expert on why the qualifications are what they are, but generally you did mention the issue of safety and health. And I think Andrew made an interesting contrast there.
Well, and there are some states where there is probably a license required. Again, I mean, there are, I think the number is, if you take what is licensed in all, you know, every state, what they require, there's over 1,100 occupations that require a license in at least one state in the U.S., but there are only about 60 that are occupations that every state requires a license in. So could very well be that if Andrew moved, he would move out of the state. He could move to a state where there might be licensing required.
Nick in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nick.
Hello. I just kind of had a comment. I'm a plumber in Columbus, Ohio, and I went through a four-year journeyman program. I'm a licensed plumber, and we lose not just plumbers but all the trades. We lose all kinds of work due to getting outbidded by unlicensed professionals. In my field, there's a ton of Band-Aids for broken legs. And I think, you know, and you need that state license to be a plumber because codes vary from state to state. We don't do hot water tanks in Ohio the same way they do in Arizona where there's earthquakes.
Yeah. I mean, there's those kind of professions where that are very technical, increasingly technical, and take a lot of education and learning. But when it's said that in the description of what you were calling about, Nick, it said that you think everybody should be licensed.
In my trade?
In your trade.
In any of the trades? Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there are some states in the U.S. where you don't need a plumbing license. You can go get a truck, advertise you're a master plumber, and the customer is no wiser.
Yeah, Julie Graber. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I want to get us off track. Kind of track here, but this actually relates to one of your previous questions. The challenge then becomes that when you look at the trades in particular, those are organizations and fields that have not been very welcoming to women and minorities. So the licensing and requirements there mean that those organizations really control who can and can be in the workforce. And this is a good example of one where demographics can really make a difference in terms of whether this is an occupation you can pursue.
Nick, thanks a lot for that call. Let's see. CK in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, CK.
Hi. I'm talking about professional engineers need to be registered because registration requirements help make sure that people are trained and educated to do design and make sure the whatever is built is proper to protect the safety of people.
Are you talking about civil engineers?
All
engineers. Oops.
Well, and it's not like...
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Julie.
You know, we're not arguing whether or not licensing ought to be required in certain occupations. The question that has been raised is whether all of the occupations that require licenses really need the licensing. And it's step up from that. Are all of the requirements in terms of education, the application process and fees related to it, testing, whether all those things are really about public safety and health, or are they really about limiting who can be in a particular field or type of job? That's the question is that folks are really kind of raising about, you know, the licensing as it exists right now.
I'm kind of wondering about the upholstery certification myself. CK, thanks a lot for your call. I mean, there's a very big difference between engineers and plumbers and electricians in these trades and upholstery, maybe cosmetology to a certain extent. And I don't know. I don't know if I want somebody working on my hair who doesn't understand how the dyes work or how the chemicals work and that kind of a thing. On the other hand, do they – the question is they have 100 or more hours of certification required than an EMT.
Yeah. Yeah, and that variation from state to state. I mean, one of the issues is military spouses, 92% of which are female. The variation from state to state means that even though they've qualified and have been working in a particular state, if they move, as military families tend to do, then they run the risk that they're going to be in a state that has higher requirements, may require additional education, limiting their employment opportunities. So some of that issue is really, you know, how much variation from state to state. And then, as you said, some of the, you know, things like we can't, you know, license in Ohio and is unlicensed somewhere else. And, you know, what's that say about how public safety and health and whether that's really a requirement?
That's Julie Graber. She's CEO of Gender Equity Analytics. That's a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity. We're talking about Ohio's occupational licensing policies. They are considered by many a barrier to work for many across the state. But on the other hand, as some of our callers have made the argument, they're important in the trades, but do they create barriers to others to getting into those trades? You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about Ohio's occupational licensing policies that can be a barrier to work for many, particularly women and minorities. Still with us by phone is CEO of Gender Equity Analytics. That's a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity, Julie Graber. Joining us is Columbus State Community College marketing professor and former director of the Ohio Division of Entrepreneurship and Small Business, Iris Cooper. Welcome to the show, Iris.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
And joining us now is senior policy analyst with Buckeye Institute, a conservative think tank in Ohio, Greg Lawson. Welcome back, Greg.
Great to be on again.
Greg has testified before the Ohio House Government Accountability and Oversight Committee over the state's licensing laws. There is legislation pending in the Ohio General Assembly that would change some of the rules. Greg, as you said, you've testified about these licensing policies. You've called it an over-licensing problem. What's been the tipping point? When you look back, when did it become onerous, in your opinion?
Well, I think that when you look back in the 60s and times like that, there were around 5% of professions that required some sort of an occupational license. And around now, we're close to 30% of professions. So we've seen at least a 25% increase in a fairly, you know, short period of time. I mean, it's been several decades. But that means that every single one of these people, and to understand what a license is, we kind of call it permission slip policies. Because in essence, you have to go to the government and seek permission from the government in order to be able to do whatever the profession is that you get the license for. That piece of paper is a permission slip for you to be able to do it. Now, you know, we recognize, you know, doctors and engineers and health and safety issues. Obviously, there are certain professions that without question require a license because of either the technical nature or the safety issue. But we are very concerned when we see things. For example, in Ohio, auctioneers are licensed. I mean, they're actually licensed through the Department of Agriculture. And that's a small example, but why are we doing that? And more importantly, the hours.
And I mean, is there a history to that? I'm curious, and I have, you know, I don't know. Why? Why upholsterers?
There's auctioneers and upholsterers. That's actually an interesting one because I'm not sure that any other state has that one, and very few states have auctioneers. So it's kind of a peculiarity. Now, there's a lot of states that where, you know, plumbers are licensed in every state and things like that. And in terms of upholsterers, I'm sure there was an incident somewhere along the way. And like with auctioneers, it's an issue where you have there's a market access question. You've got people who want to be able to say somebody said they need to know how to look at the products and how to do everything fairly. And there was somebody who said this was a good idea back in the day. And so it kind of stuck. And nobody's really raised the question of why do we need to continue to do this? And I think that's how a lot of these things start. There's always maybe there's an incident. Maybe there's a bad actor who did something they shouldn't do. And somebody's like, wow, there's a fly-by-night guy. Somebody did something wrong to a consumer. So we need to make sure that that doesn't happen again. And back in the older days, maybe that made more sense. And what I mean is, back in the day, you didn't have information at your fingertips the way we have now.
You've said that it's not as much of a buyer beware situation as it used to be,
right.
Where you didn't have any knowledge. Iris Cooper, what about the impact on entrepreneurship and small business when it comes to these kinds of licensing requirements?
Well, this is my theory. Whenever I'm going to call it the ruling class, the people that make the decisions, feel threatened in their position, in power, they raise the bar. It happens in every industry. And they create these little kingdoms like labor unions and certifications and additional education requirements, or you've got to go to this institute or a certification. This process has been going on for decades, that every time a minority or someone that's not in the in crowd gets close to achieving economic success, the rules change.
I remember back in the 90s when the accountancy board extended by an entire year the number of years of education to become a certified public accountant. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people thought it just kind of went under the radar. I was the nerd that went crazy over it because it was very clear to show the statistics about what that would cost in the terms of entry level, I mean, an entree into the field.
It's almost like a rite of passage, like some kind of huge test that you have to pass, and the criteria keeps changing. I can tell you, I received my doctorate degree in 2016, and I could not believe how difficult some of the reviewers were for simple things that I consider to be, you know, like just almost like clerical errors. But to justify their position, I believe, decision makers have to maintain control over their kingdom and justify who they are and their position. So I think it's a philosophy that's come from centuries ago, that the wealthy people create the laws.
You mentioned about changing rules and kind of the shifting sands of these kinds of policies. And Danielle, in Columbus, you're on the air. You're a licensed pharmacy technician, and you have a story about that.
Hi, my name is Danielle.
Mm-hmm. Welcome.
And I became a licensed pharmacy technician this past year. And the interesting thing about Ohio is before this past year, anyone could literally walk off the street and work in a pharmacy. As a pharmacy technician, without getting any education or having any background knowledge of it.
I did it. Go ahead.
for example, you could have someone working at a Walgreens, and the people back in the pharmacy need help with it, and they would call the person back, you know, working at the cashier and say, oh, can you help me get the meds together and all this kind of stuff.
Yep.
And they had no laws and regulations in Ohio concerning that.
Yep.
So this past year, they started to make changes with that, which has been good. But I think they're making the changes in a very infant stage, and they need to be enforcing it better, the state of Ohio.
So you want more regulation?
You know, I think what they passed this past year is just a start with it. And I hope that the state of Ohio is going to be.
Why do you hope that? Why do you think it's important?
Well, I think because you know, for example, like with the issues with the opioid and all the drug problems that people are having, people can have easier access to it.
Okay.
And I think that it's from a public health point of view, they need to be, you know. Getting more people educated. They need to be requiring courses and all this kind of stuff.
Okay.
That other states have that Ohio does not have right now.
And you were licensed. What did it cost you to become a licensed pharmacy technician? Did you have to go to school?
Yes. Well, what I did was I went to Columbus State, and I took four classes over the summer. And when I told And then I took a national exam.
Uh-huh.
And when I told people that, oh, that's all you have to do, you know, and I was looking at other states and stuff, and I think Ohio is just so far behind is what they require. And so I'm hoping that this law that they passed this past year will be kind of a jumping board, you know, a starting.
All right. Well, Danielle, thank you for your thoughts. I mean, first let me ask Julie Graber. Danielle's coming kind of enlightening us. It used to be anybody could move up that food chain, but it's not as if you could get to be a pharmacist by helping count pills.
Right. I mean, that's good. And again, you go back to, and that's certainly an example of where, you know, just changes in our culture have probably raised questions about what the standards ought to be for someone who can work in a pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not about whether certifications or licensing is, in a lot of cases, needed for public safety and health. The question is, you know, is that really the concern in all cases, and are all of the requirements in a particular state really necessary when you look at the variation that exists from state to state?
Danielle, thanks for that call. Greg Lawson, I wonder if this isn't one of those things that 50 years from now, when it's all roboticized anyways, automated, I should say, anyways, if they'll wonder, well, why would they ever need the certification back in the day?
Well, I think that's I agree. And I think that you obviously, I mean, the caller brought up issues with the opioid crisis and things like that. And obviously that is a very serious issue. But you're not talking about the folks that are actually doing the actual chemical aspects and the mixing together of the stuff and things of that nature. So I think you got to be, look at that and be careful. And I guess I'll kind of walk it back a little bit and say, you know, without opining too much on that specific example, because there is at least the issue with the safety because you're taking pills that people ingest. But we're talking about, I mentioned the auctioneers, you've talked cosmetology, and we've got the issue where we've got 1,500 hours in Ohio to be a cosmetologist, and you got the 150 hours for the EMT to be certified EMT. So you've got sort of a pretty significant disparity there, and you've got legislation, obviously, in Ohio that's seeking to reduce that from 15 to 1,000 hours. Those are the kind of things I think we should be spending a lot of time on, because we're talking about how many people can get into work. There's a labor issue in the salon industry. You know, we have issues where people are able to get out from career tech centers, and the 1,500 hours for a cosmetologist in a career tech center, they actually have less hours of the actual what they have to do to get the cosmetology license when they're doing that, because some of that 1,500 hours is actually high school stuff, typical high school work. So you have already less hours for people that are coming out of high school and career centers and going into a salon as a fully licensed cosmetologist, mm-hmm. versus having to go out, and if you didn't do it then, having to spend maybe $20,000 to get a license through maybe a private school. And I'm not trying to cast aspersions on those folks. I'm just saying, does 1,500 hours make sense in that industry? You know, and so we need to ask ourselves the kind of questions about what makes sense. Sometimes it may not be we unlicense a professional. Maybe we need to reevaluate what the hours are. For example, again, with cosmetologists, it's 1,000 hours in New York and Massachusetts. Why is it 1,000 there and 15 here?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it all seems, because when you look at it on a state-by-state basis, Iris Cooper, it does look pretty arbitrary. I mean,
there's no hard and fast rule to how they decide who needs to be in school for 3 years or 6 months. But one thing for sure is it costs money. It costs money to people that are already unemployed. So that leads people.
You have to be out of the workforce to get the experience to achieve the certification.
And you've got to spend money, money that you don't have. And you may not be able to recoup if you can't find traditional employment to pay those student loans back.
And this disproportionately affects low-income and minorities.
Absolutely.
Greg Lawson, mm-hmm. to what extent? How do we know that?
Well, if you look at – we actually did a report. We've done a couple of reports on licensing, and we had our research center look at the licensing and the mobility of people with licensing. And what that means is the ability for people to move to different places, and it looked at the different barriers and the different amount of barriers from different states and what that would do. And they looked at different cross-sections of the population. When you look at younger folks and when you look at non-college educated folks, but they're still getting a license, what that means for their ability to move around to get to places where there's higher wages so that they can make a better living for themselves. There's definitely a dearth of that in terms of people being able to move around. And I mean, that's just kind of, in a sense, it almost is common sense that that would happen because of the differential rates and how high it might be in different states. And the issue you got to think about is, you know, spending $20,000 if you come from an upper middle class or a high class family that is well off financially, that's not that big of, that might not be that big of a deal for you. But if you're coming from somebody who is at the federal poverty line or is 150% of the federal poverty level, spending that amount of money and then having to have your wages garnished for years after the fact, which is what happens, that's pretty massive. And another thing, like, again, and I don't mean to beat up on it, but the cosmetology issue, when you're doing a lot of these private schools, some of those hours are time on the floor that you're not actually getting paid. So you've got a salon school that's making money off of a client coming in to get their haircut, but you, as the actual worker who's doing the work, you're not getting paid because it's going towards your education. Well, that doesn't seem very fair. Those are hours that are taken off of you making money. Somebody else is making money off of your labor at that point, and you're still not getting it. So how much does that work for somebody who is already maybe in a tight situation, the single mother who's got, you know, several kids at home, and she's trying to get out there so she can deal with this stuff, and she's not making any money until she actually gets that permission slip? That's a real problem. And it's always going to be more impactful because higher costs always harm people who are struggling more than obviously people that are not.
Iris?
Well, a recent study that was supported by the Women's Policy Research Council, mm-hmm. and the National Domestic Workers Alliance stated that 80% of Black mothers are the breadwinners for their families. Now, again, this is a cultural shift. The two-parent household isn't the norm anymore, especially with minorities and women. And so when Black women are living in poverty, their whole community is living in poverty. So when we put these barriers up to being able to step out in an entrepreneurial fashion and support themselves and their families, it's hurting the community.
Julie Grieber, is there any are there any models out there of states that have addressed this issue that you're aware of? Is anyone doing anything on this score to start to look at these professions and figure out how to make them, how to make the hours for certification make more sense?
Yeah, there's actually a good model with the registered with nursing. There is actually a coalition of states that have come together and agreed that here are here's a set of requirements that everybody needs to fulfill, and the states can still have can impose some additional challenges for folks or additional requirements. But basically, nurses can get registered as part of this kind of 30-state coalition, and they can work in those 30 states if they qualify. If they don't, like there's one, you know, one state may not let individuals who've been felons apply for this particular license, and another state it may be okay. But in general, the states have agreed they will accept this certification as the licensing necessary for someone to work as a registered nurse. So that's an example of a place where the states have come together, you know, developed a core requirement that they all agree to, and it's made it easier for individuals who work in that profession to move from state to state.
We will continue our conversation about how state licensing policies can protect us, but also limit access into different fields. You just heard from Julie Grieber. She's CEO of Gender Equity Analytics. It's a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity. Also with us, Iris Cooper. She's a marketing professor at Columbus State Community College, former director of the Ohio Division of Entrepreneurship and Small Business, and also Greg Lawson, a senior policy analyst with Buckeye Institute. If you have a question or comment, I'd love to hear from an upholsterer who had to get to get a license in the state of Ohio and find out what it is that you had to do and why. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about Ohio's occupational licensing policies and whether they hamper especially women and minorities when it comes to access into professions. Still with us by phone is CEO of Gender Equity Analytics, a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity, Julie Grieber, and Columbus State Community College marketing professor and former director of the Ohio Division of Entrepreneurship and Small Business, Iris Cooper, and senior policy analyst with Buckeye Institute. That's a conservative think tank, Greg Lawson. They've been working a lot on a handful of bills that have been working their way through the Ohio General Assembly, especially House Bill 255. It's cleared. Senate Bill 255. It's cleared the Senate. It's in the House. Greg, what do you know about the expectations that this bill, which would reduce or have a create a series of criteria for licensing, how it's going?
Yeah, it's a great package because what it does is it creates a new framework for how we look at this. We've been talking a lot about the challenges that licensing does, the hurdles that it erects in front of folks, especially, you know, women, minorities, all of that. So what we were saying is we need to have a process that reviews this, and we should have it be the state policy to seek the least restrictive regulation that's necessary to be public safety. So, you know, doctors, yeah, okay, I think everybody agrees they're probably going to be licensed. But all these other type of professions, what do we need to do? So we create a definition where we actually look at alternatives to licensure. So it's not you have to license or do nothing, but licensure, again, is a permission slip. You have to have it or you cannot do that profession in the state. Now, certification, especially if it's a private certification, that's not necessarily the case. You may not be able to market yourself as certified if you're not certified, but you could theoretically still at least do it. And if you have a customer base that's okay with that, then you can still make money and have a living. You're not prohibited.
Okay.
So we're saying you should look at alternatives to licensure if that still will accomplish the end. Now, maybe there's no need for a license at all, in which case you would let the free market work do that.
You say the free market would work, that people, if you don't know what you're doing, that's going to get around and you won't have work anyway.
But I think, right, exactly. And all. But there's a hierarchy of different things. So if you're concerned that somebody's going to cheat you out of something or misrepresent things, and the license is the thing that everybody, the license people say, you got to have a license or you're going to have a fly-by-night person. Well, there's a Consumer Sales Practice Act. You can strengthen the Consumer Sales Practice Act and add the ability to go after people who basically are disingenuous and do things that they're not supposed to do. There's a whole group of things. We call it the inverted pyramid, which means we go from what we're trying, what 255, Senate Bill 255 would say that the state should look at this through an inverted pyramid from the least restrictive to the most restrictive regulation and then make a decision as they're reviewing it. So it reviews all these boards. Every licensing board in the state would be reviewed on a rotating basis. And the idea is that they make recommendations. But here's the key. If the General Assembly does not proactively reauthorize a board, it would cease. You know, now we've been around for a while.
Well,
we know what
I'm
that means.
I'm rolling my eyes a little bit because I just don't see the Ohio General Assembly taking on a task like this.
Well, I mean, it's going to take the will of the legislature. There's no doubt about that. And you're right.
It's a lot of work. I mean, I just see a whole other ream or raft of
It's like the Tax
hearings.
Expenditure Review Committee looks at tax expenditures and then issues a report and says, here they are. But that's why we do like the sunset, because that at least makes the General Assembly
forces them to do something. Yeah.
Right.
Let's see. We got Jody in Columbus. You're a pharmacist, and you wanted to correct a few things that were asserted by the farm technician. Go ahead, yes. Jody.
Yes. So the requirement that changed last year was that the technician actually now has to be licensed by the State Board of Pharmacy. But there were training requirements in place for years before that.
Okay.
So the training is different than the licensure, and that's the change that occurred last year.
And all
so
things
the
being
– the woman who called in previously wasn't – accurate.
She's new in the field, but let me ask you this. So that's exactly what Greg Lawson was just talking about, Jody, that there's licensing, which is a barrier to it, and then there's certification, which is sort of a badge of honor. It's not a barrier. If you're not certified, the pharmacy ostensibly can say, we only hire certified pharmacy techs. Now there's a requirement that you must be licensed to be a pharmacy tech. Is there any, I mean, what's the rub, or is there no rub, Jody?
You know, this definitely created a brouhaha at work when the requirements were communicated to us.
That you had to have licensed,
the technicians, yes, because really they see it as, oh, this is so much money that I now have to pay to the state. And in reality, I was doing the same thing before.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what was happening previously was it was the place of employment responsibility to ensure that pharmacy technician was in fact trained appropriately or certified appropriately.
And now they the state's responsible for it.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, Jody, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Yeah, Iris, does that ring a bell with you? I mean, it's...
Well, what I'm thinking about is something I would encourage everyone to think about is the bigger picture here.
Mm-hmm.
We're losing retail workers, who are primarily women. We've got robots and drones taking over manufacturing jobs. And that used to be the passage to the middle class. So culturally, the roles that women used to play are disappearing. So they're going to have other alternatives to supporting families. Black women in particular are the most educated and the least compensated in the whole spectrum of workers. And so we're looking at down the road just an overall decline in those jobs that women and black women used to be able to secure. So when you come up with an additional hurdle, like, $12,000 to get a license.
Or even, let's say, $175 fee.
Absolutely. And ongoing fees to be recertified. And that's not just in the beauty industry. That's child care. That's goes, you just have no idea what's already in the hopper to try to make money. This is motivated by greed, by income. And as I said, it's kind of something that's come down historically to keep the haves from the have-nots.
Julie Graber, I think that that's really interesting that when Jody called in and made that clarification, it underscored what Greg Lawson was saying. Now, you know, used to be the pharmacies, and I used to be work as a pharmacy tech when I wasn't, you know, selling perfume at the front counter. I would go back and count pills. This is 100 years ago, of course. Things have changed, but still, I wouldn't have been able to do that. I wouldn't have had that job.
Yeah, I mean, it may have led to you losing the job that you had. If,
right.
You know, if there wasn't enough work to keep you busy doing other things than counting pills. So,
You guys
made a good point in the distinction between licensing often being a barrier, whereas certification is something that, you know, indicates that someone has had perhaps additional training, met higher standards, and very often means that that individual is paid more, can charge more because of that certification than folks who aren't certified. So, I mean, it can be kind of a little financial bump if that's something that people find of additional value worth pursuing.
Let's see. Clara and Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Clara.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
I am a salon owner in the Dayton area, and actually I have salons. I've quite a few salons. I'm proud to be the employer of around 700 predominantly women who are licensed cosmetologists, and I am probably a pretty extraordinary supporter of what Greg and others are working to do in terms of reducing the hours for cosmetologists. Because I hire people from both the public schools and the private schools, and I know that Greg shared earlier that the public schools, the requirement is right around 1,000 hours because they have the math, the sciences, and so on to fulfill their high school graduation requirements. And so I do know from the State Board of Cosmetology, from a result standpoint, the pass-fail rates on the exams are very similar, no noticeable difference. And the quality of the hire, whether it's, you know, in terms of their ability, not only to provide services, but also their ability to use the infection control standards that are necessary. They're very similar. I can't see a difference between those two people. So I think, you know, and more than half of the people graduating and getting their cosmetology licenses now are from the public schools. We've had, I believe, almost 30 private school closures in Ohio. So there's a sign there somewhere that something's going on because of the closures. And so there are far more public schools, high school programs with cosmetology at this point.
Okay.
So,
and they already, it's 1,000 hours. And so you're not seeing much of a difference in the quality of the product coming out of the schools versus the private schools.
I think that the training and their ability is very, very similar. They are required to provide the same things in the curriculum. So, of course, you would expect. And we have to remind ourselves that this going to school to be a licensed cosmetologist is not, that's not a diploma. That gives you the right to go and sit for the exam, which is what you need to pass to have the license. And so, I think there's a really big difference there. They're not getting, the high schoolers are getting their high school diploma, but there is no diploma associated with fulfilling that hours obligation.
Okay.
I also see the debt I mean, I have to tell you, I have several garnishments going on right now. These are young ladies that went back to school. Most of them are single parent, head of household. They are trying to have a trade and have the ability to earn a really good income. And unfortunately, I've had people with anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000 in debt.
Wow. To get that certification, to get that. Yeah. Okay. Clara, thank you so much. I appreciate your time, and thanks for the call. I wanted to turn to Michelle now. Michelle in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I'm a sign language interpreter, and in our field, it's obviously not as big as other professions, but it's also predominantly female-dominated, and it's not regulated on the national level, and it's regulated state by state.
Uh-huh.
And in Ohio, we don't have really any laws. There's a few little rules within, like, the Department of Education and through the Supreme Court of Ohio
mm-hmm.
for certain areas. But what we've seen in other states where they do have certification and licensure requirements, that there is more of a regulation, and you see that in Ohio we don't have that, and you can end up having people who are not qualified being hired or placed on jobs where, like, deaf people are not getting adequate and appropriate and qualified interpreters.
So there's an example, Greg Lawson, and what do you how do you counter that? I mean, so here's somebody saying there should be upping the requirements.
Well, I guess I would say that if somebody is not providing the level of service that's necessary, you would do with that person probably what you would do in any other field, which is they probably would be finding something else to be doing. And I guess what I mean by that is that I don't know. That may be true that you may have some people doing it. I'm not sure if this is – if the caller is saying that there's like a rash of this and that this is the common thing. But I would say that – and again, that you wouldn't still say that, hey, let's just do a license to do this. Now, I'm assuming there's private organization. I'm not real familiar with the intricacies of that field, but I'm assuming there's private organizations that have coursework that you can do to get certified rather than licensed and still have a quality, and then you would market yourself with the stamp mm-hmm. of approval of the national whatever association there is or that does this kind of work. And if you're dedicated to it, I would think that there's a good chance you would voluntarily choose
to do that.
So, again,
you're saying buyer beware.
I think
know who you're hiring.
And when you hire somebody and they're not functional or not doing that, you're going to replace them. And a person can make a voluntary choice to, get that certification. But to say that you have to have that, that's a pretty draconian thing when you think about it, because that is literally saying thou shalt not do this job at all under any set of circumstances ever, or you are violating the law, and the government can come after you and fine you or whatever it is they want to do to you. That's pretty extreme. So I think we need to think about there are other levels that we can do this at, and it doesn't always have to be licensure, and people can choose that. So I'm not sure if I see that as quite as the problem that the caller indicated.
Iris Cooper, we're just about out of time.
I was just thinking this sounds like a cat chasing its tail situation, because I see this as an evolution of looking at the economy and every part of it as a contributor. And so when it's broken up into pieces like it is, where there's certifications and license and apprenticeships and labor unions, all of these clubs or memberships or whatever you want to call them, don't necessarily facilitate entry into the workforce in a meaningful way. They are intended to keep a certain group of people in control of the major cash flow, in my opinion. And we need to be finding every way possible to take breadwinners, Black women, women, and giving them the opportunity to earn a livable wage with education, the requisite education. But thank you.
Iris Cooper from Columbus State Community College. Also, Greg Lawson, Senior Policy Analyst with the Buckeye Institute. And Julie Graber of Gender Equity Analytics. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks especially for all the great calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.